Two main threads in this program today. One, keeping this economy open, and two, some of the basic flaws in this economy as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 3rd of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I will note this as we get going today, and then we can put it behind us because, you know, pandemic and economic crisis and systemic economic racism are better uses of our airtime. Somehow, again today, traders looked around and said, yeah, no, it's all good. Back to near record highs. As Sabri Benishore said on this program yesterday, maybe the stock market is aliens. Could be. Okay, to the rest of this day's news, we're going to do a little economic infrastructure right now. Say what you will about the Federal Reserve, and people do. The Fed's lending programs, the trillions of dollars worth of them, have kept the bottom from completely falling out. And there is a new program rolling out this week. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what the Fed is calling its Main Street Lending Program.
When you look at the details of the program, Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says maybe the name's a little misleading.
It's only the Main Street program if the Main Street in your town looks a lot like Park Avenue.
Businesses with as many as 15,000 employees can apply. Loan sizes range from $500,000 to $25 million. Petru says that's not much for, say, GM, but
small grocers, cafes, restaurants, hairdressers, car repair shops, many of them never see $500,000 in annual revenue, let alone could pay back a loan that big.
The program's more likely to appeal to specialized manufacturers, software companies, and other mid-sized businesses, says Matt Hetrick, who runs the accounting firm Harmony Group. He says for some of those companies, borrowing money might make sense in the long run.
You know, what's the cost of losing all of that talent or shutting this thing down versus the cost of borrowing some money to get through an expected loss period?
Smaller companies may not be able to apply for these loans, but they'll benefit, says Jeremy Swan at the accounting and advisory firm Cohn Resnick.
Let's just say that you are a small local grocery store. Who are your suppliers? You know, typically they're going to be the medium and larger sized businesses.
The Fed's charging more interest than the PPP program, and these loans can't be forgiven. Businesses will have to pay them off in 4 years. Nathan Roggi runs the Bank of Southern California. He says that's not enough time for many of his clients.
These are clients that are clearly in duress. They don't know exactly where things are going. And so when you give them a loan with such a short amortization, it's really hard to get comfortable with it.
Congress appropriated almost $700 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program. But Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said there basically won't be a limit to this one. Treasury and the Federal Reserve can simply make more funds available. Since the money won't run out, Rocky says a lot of businesses are holding off.
Businesses and banks are in a position of let's wait and see exactly how this works. So I just don't feel that urgency to have an application in the day that it opens up.
In the meantime, Roggi says he's been helping clients apply to other federal and state loan programs with longer repayment windows. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
More, by the way, on that Paycheck Protection Program coming up a little bit later in the broadcast. One of the ways that racism manifests itself in this economy, specifically in that part of the economy where entrepreneurs and venture capitalists come together to work on the new thing, is that black and minority founders get a vanishingly small percentage of seed money. SoftBank, the big Japanese conglomerate, says it's going to invest at least $100 million in companies led by people of color. One notes here for context that its main startup fund, it's called the Vision Fund, comes in at $100 billion. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on the VC racial divide.
Here's the thing about raising capital. A little doesn't go a long way. Lauren Milan is the interim CEO of Digital Undivided, a nonprofit that supports women of color entrepreneurs.
There is so much celebration around that first round of funding. The need for ongoing support is lost.
She says founders of color don't just have a harder time getting initial funding. They get less of it. While the average seed funding for all startups hovers around $1 million, the average Black female founder, according to Digital Undivided, raises $42,000 in total.
They are almost immediately going back into that same funding environment again to seek additional funds.
That's what happened to Jasmine Edwards. In 2018, she founded iSubs, a digital marketplace that connected substitute teachers and schools. She raised $43,000, much less than that $1 million average.
Not only do the people that raise that significant amount get to hire the team that they need, they also have enough runway to make the mistakes and to play.
She had to shut down the company in part because she spent so much time trying to raise money. It took away from actually building the company. And Jeffrey Robinson, an economic development professor at Rutgers University, says that creates a chicken and egg problem. Because to get more money, you have to prove you're growing.
How's that company doing? Is it meeting its goals?
And Robinson says founders of color who have fewer VC firms to choose from will also have a harder time building their web of contacts, which is important to create a board and to raise even more money. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street, we touched on. The aliens were in charge once again today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When there are street protests, often property gets damaged. And when property gets damaged, often there are cleanups that have to be done if an economy is to recover. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
30-year-old Kevin Zetazabal lives in the Bronx, a lower-income New York borough that's mostly Black and Latino. When he saw stores in his neighborhood being damaged during this recent wave of protests, he was upset. So he put out a call for help on social media. He didn't know what to expect. In the event, around 1,000 volunteers showed up, and his appeal raised nearly $40,000, which he says he'll be donating to businesses that didn't have insurance.
The only way to keep the community going is if we take care of it. And this is what we're doing. This is how we're going to invest the money that we are raising, because we are the community.
But property damage is on a much lower scale than in past protests, like those in the 1960s after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Today's incidents are being overstated, says Professor Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University. He says there's a lot of hysteria on social media. And although there has been damage to minority-owned businesses and Black neighborhoods,
actually, the economic violence visited upon these neighborhoods is far more damaging.
He's talking about lack of investment, low wages, and a general dearth of opportunity. Unlike in the past, he notes, the recent disturbances haven't been concentrated exclusively in low-income Black and brown neighborhoods. They've also hit businesses in wealthy, predominantly white areas like Soho in Manhattan. And he says there's reason to believe those wealthier neighborhoods will rebound far more quickly than the poorer ones. Professor Jamian Cunningham with Memphis University agrees.
These events are associated with negative consequences afterwards. More police killings of civilians, lower property values, less job opportunities, population leaving these communities, both white and Black. And so you do want to be aware that you really want to address some of these underlying inequities that exist in society.
In other words, a broken window is easy to fix. The hard work is fixing why it got broken in the first place. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Take a look at Amazon's top 20 nonfiction bestsellers of the past week. You might notice a pattern. White Fragility is one title. How to Be an Anti-Racist. So you want to talk about race? Me and White Supremacy. Those are for the adults. Much of the same in the children's section, and not just on Amazon either, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Online book sales have been steady through the pandemic for Mahogany Books in Washington, D.C. It's a Black-owned bookstore with mostly Black customers. Then came the killing of George Floyd and the protests. Owner Ramunda Young says she's heard from a lot of new customers in the past week who are telling her,
"Hey, I never realized this thing was this deep, or I was very unaware. I'm feeling like hopeless, but also in a space of where I want to learn and be educated."
Young says most of her new clients are white, and lots of them are buying books for their kids. At Wild Rumpus Children's Bookstore in Minneapolis, Katie McKinley, a manager, says 95% of their recent book sales are about race and social justice, and people are buying 10, 12 at a time.
The volume is something we've never seen before.
Katie Bordner, a white woman in Pittsburgh, recently ordered some books for her 2.5-year-old son.
Having him exposed to it early, and then as things happen in our world, we're going to be revisiting these books and putting what happens in the world in the context of understanding these books.
This swell of interest in books about race is something that Danielle Clayton of nonprofit We Need Diverse Books has seen before.
This always happens. This is this, like, literally every single time there is any sort of a flare-up or event, we get a whole bunch of, oh my gosh, outrage. And then everyone goes back home and it gets quiet again.
But this time, she says, like the protests, it feels bigger. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
A lot of the videos and the pictures and the audio reporting as well of the protests over the killing of George Floyd show pretty clearly that protesters are being met by police using military-grade equipment. That's not a new truth. It's been happening for more than a decade now. Back in 2016, there was a documentary out about exactly that topic. It was called Do Not Resist. Craig Atkinson was the director, and we talked to him when that movie came out. But we thought maybe playing that interview again today might be a good idea. So here you go. Me talking to Craig Atkinson in 2016 about his film, Do Not Resist. You start this film in Ferguson, Missouri, two summers ago, after the events of that summer in that town. What was it about that scene that got you thinking about making this film?
Well, we actually started a year prior to Ferguson. My father was a police officer for 29 years outside of Detroit, and he was actually also a SWAT officer for 13 of those years. And so I kind of grew up with the war on drugs era of policing around the kitchen table. And so when I saw the Boston Marathon bombing, I saw a complete departure from the era of SWAT that my dad was in to what I saw, you know, playing out in the days after the Boston Marathon bombing. And what we discovered during the course of making this film, well, $39 billion worth of military hardware had been gifted to domestic law enforcement agencies. And like any other investment, you get the returns, you know, where you put the energy. And in this case, we invested in weapons, and we're seeing the aftermath of that now.
And local police departments are using that money to buy what? Because the thing that becomes clear in this film is that it's more than just M16s and some Kevlar vests.
Sure. I mean, you know, surveillance technology is something that's also being fused into police work. And, you know, if you just look at the equipment, I personally don't have a problem with the equipment because, you know, my father was a police officer who had to go into dangerous situations. And look no further than the Pulse nightclub shooting where they used an armored vehicle to puncture a hole. Yeah, down in Orlando to puncture a hole in the building, which allowed the hostages to go free. So we all can identify areas where you absolutely need this equipment. However, you know, going on ride-alongs for the last 3 years, everyone says that we're going to use this for terrorism, except for we never saw anyone use it for terrorism. But on a day-to-day basis, they were using it to raid houses, oftentimes for low-level drug offenses.
You went to a whole bunch of places in small town America. You went to Wisconsin, I think. You also went up to New Hampshire. There's footage of these giant, mine resistant armored protected vehicles. They're MRAPs, they're called, driving through these small town streets. And you also went to some city council meetings. And I want to play a piece of tape from the film here. It's citizen testimony at a city council meeting where they are apparently debating whether or not to take money to buy some of this military surplus stuff. And I'm just going to play that and then we'll talk about it. Here you go.
If you had told me 20 years ago when I was serving my country and defending it against the Soviet Union that someday we would have armored personnel carriers used to roam the streets of Concord, New Hampshire, I would have told you you're a raving lunatic.
Concord, New Hampshire, population not very big, and total murders in 2014 was like zero or two or something. It struck me as these trucks were driving through these towns, the sort of the cognitive dissonance there.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the justification is, you know, terrorism can happen anywhere. And while that may be the case, I just think that we need to reconsider how we're spending money in our communities. When we went down to Texas and saw these MRAPs sitting in a field, well, they all cost $1.2 million each. And we were at an Army depot and we were driving and there were miles of them, miles and miles of them.
Has your dad, who was, as you said, a cop for 29 years and a SWAT officer for 10 or 12, has he seen this film?
He sure has. You know, he appreciates what I do as a filmmaker, but I must say that he was pretty devastated to see a profession that he dedicated his life to evolve into something that, you know, he would never identify with. But, you know, there's been a huge increase. If you think about it, he was on SWAT for 13 years. They did 29 search warrants total. Contrast that with a department that we would go out with during the course of making this film, and they were doing 3 to 4 a day, 200 times a year. And so there's been a significant mission creep. And so that was very disappointing for him to witness.
It's a new documentary. It's called Do Not Resist. The filmmaker is Craig Atkins. Craig, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up,
we have about 80 loans in the pipeline now. We have a few come in every day.
I know it seems like forever ago, but the Paycheck Protection Program is still a thing. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so the aliens had it today. I don't know what to tell you. Dow Industrial's up 527, just over 2%, closed at 26,269. The NASDAQ up 74, about 0.7%, 96 and 82. The S&P 500 picked up 42 points. That's about 1.3%, 31 and 22 there. Today is the day when Warner Music Group dropped. That's music industry slang for when a record makes its IPO, in case you didn't know. Shares in the world's number three record label made their debut today, too, gained more than 20%. Optimism about economic recovery sent airline and related stocks up today. American Airlines up 5.6%. Delta added 7.8%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.74%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. China hit a tiny bit of a milestone last month. Its service sector, that's stuff like retail and banking, travel, those kinds of things, in all about 60% of its economy. Well, it grew in May for the first time since the beginning of the year. So good news for Chinese workers. Also good news for the Chinese government, which is prioritizing job security as that economy gets back up to speed. But as so often happens, the law of unintended consequences would like a word here. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack explains from Shanghai.
IT worker Eric Chen says he survived a round of layoffs at work just before the pandemic hit China in January. Then mid-April came.
My direct supervisor pulled me into a meeting room and said, "I hope you can start looking for another job."
Eric says his boss gave him at most 2 months to hand in his resignation and suggested don't fight back.
My direct supervisor said it in a nice way. He reminded me that I need a good reference from the company to get a new job.
He says it felt like he was being pushed out. Same for Zhang Xianfeng, who worked at a cell phone plant for Lenovo, a Chinese firm that purchased Motorola and IBM's personal computers division. Overseas clients had been canceling their orders, so Zhang Xianfeng didn't get as much overtime.
In a week, I'd work a couple days and then have 2 to 3 days off.
With fewer hours and no overtime pay, his earnings dropped by more than half. So he resigned, as did, he says, dozens of other workers late last month.
On the surface, it looks like we're resigning, but what the factory is doing is a mass layoff.
That's what advocacy group China Labor Bulletin has been hearing, too, from factory workers in other parts of the country. If they resign, then companies don't have to pay compensation. But some employees feel there might be other reasons. Again, IT worker Eric Chen.
As long as a company doesn't lay off workers during the pandemic, the government will give the firm preferential policies or subsidies such as tax rebates. That's why no company wants to be seen cutting jobs.
Eric could take his case to the Labor Bureau, though he won't, because he lives in a city of 11 million, bigger than the population of Greater LA, but small by Chinese standards.
In a small city, going through the Labor Bureau could hurt my reputation in the job market.
Plus, fighting for his rights would take time. Time, he says, that would be better spent finding a new job. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Small Business Administration says more than a month in, there's still around $110 billion left in the second round of the Paycheck Protection Program, the possibly forgivable loans that were part of the main economic rescue package. That's a quite different situation than we were telling you about back in April when the first round of PPP funding ran out in something less than 2 weeks. And oh, by the way, didn't always wind up with small businesses. We had Lori Stewart on the program as all that was happening. She's the president and CEO of Sound Community Bank up in Seattle, Washington, and we have gotten her back on the phone. Ms. Stewart, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Let's see, we spoke a month ago, maybe, plus or minus, and you were basically out of money for the PPP loan program, but you had lots of people waiting. How did that work out?
Well, that's true. We made about 300 loans for $48 million and then ran out of money and had about 200 folks still in the pipeline. But I'm really excited to tell you, and I am genuinely excited, that we were able to get all of those folks in the second round. And in fact, we got them in the first couple of days of the second round. Wow. And I'd also like to share, if you don't mind, that our smallest loan is $900.
Wow. That's what, all right. So without, you know, identifying information, what kind of business was it? Do you remember? Do you
know? So it's a self-employed individual. One of the things we saw in round two is lots smaller dollar amounts and lots of self-employed. That's because in round one, the guidance for that didn't come out till the last couple of days. So those folks, the gig workers, the contract workers, we saw a lot more of those in the second round, and we're still seeing them. We have about 80 loans in the pipeline now. We have a few come in every day. We're trying to spread the word that there's still money, especially to those maybe underbanked businesses that may not think they qualify.
Can we turn to forgiveness here for a minute? Because that was one of the really attractive things about this program for, I imagine, a lot of small businesses. It is, and look, I've read up on this, but I'm no scholar on it. It is enormously complicated.
It is complicated. And I think bankers and small businesses together took a leap of faith and said, this is the right thing. We're going to apply for this money, and we're going to hope we can get through the forgiveness process. Now, we're just enforcing the rules of the SBA, right? So clients come to us and say, well, what's this, and should we do that, and how do we interpret that? And we kind of get stuck between the SBA and the small business. And we say to the small business person, you know, you might consult with your attorney or your accountant. Well, if I'm the guy that got that $900 loan, I am my accountant, right? I don't have any money for an attorney.
Yeah. Do me a favor and take a step back here, would you, Ms. Stewart, and think big economic picture. You are a person who's been in banking her whole life. She knows what's going on in her community. You're in touch with your customers and your clients. What's your big economic worry right now?
It might be a little bit different than it was if you and I'd had this phone call even a couple of days ago. I am the somber events in our country, the massive number of people we have on the streets in protest, which is part of our American heritage. And yet I look on the TV and I watch the streets outside my home and I see all those people together, not masked, And I feel like, is this the beginning of that much faster second spike? And how will small business that we're just starting to get reopened be able to overcome some of the hurdles now? It's a real challenge.
Lori Stewart is the president and CEO of Sound Community Bank up in Seattle. Also, by the way, the chair of the American Bankers Association. Ms. Stewart, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for asking. Anytime.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
This final note on the way out today comes as no surprise, I guess, but still, it's kind of wild. AMC, the world's biggest movie theater chain, says in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, it's not sure it's going to make it through the pandemic. Substantial doubt is the phrase it used. We are generating essentially zero revenue, the company wrote. And this is wonky SEC language, but the filing goes on. We have never previously experienced a complete cessation of our operations, and as a consequence, our ability to be predictive is uncertain, which, yeah. Here is your moment of economic context as we close, brought to you today by the letters A, D, and P. ADP is the big payroll processing company, and once a month, on the Wednesday before the Labor Department comes out with the official unemployment figures on a Friday, ADP publishes its guess as to how many jobs were added or lost in this economy in the previous month. Anyway, today was such a Wednesday, and as ADP said this morning, we lost 2.7 million jobs in May. That's their guess. It is also staggering, but guesses had been for something like 9 million jobs lost. So A, that's great. B, we're going to wait for the official word come Friday. All right, we're going. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. This being a Wednesday, I'll also say that they are the ones going into the studios so that the rest of us don't have to. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.